From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Today, we present you with a balanced budget that shows what is possible if we all come together on a comprehensive approach.
How much would the total spending of the state would be if the grand bargain doesn't pass?
The maintenance autopilot budget, if there were no changes in law, would have a deficit of $7.2 billion. But the governor has requested authority to balance the budget.
It's interesting to note that for 198 years of Illinois' 200-year history, we've always gone through a very standard process that is required by our Constitution of the governor coming to the legislature, presenting a complete, detailed, balanced budget. The last 2 years, we've just not seen this process.
Governor Bruce Rauner delivered his budget address this week. You heard some reaction to it. What does his plan mean for getting a deal and ending the long-running impasse? Also, state workers, well, they'll keep getting their paychecks, at least for now. We'll talk about that and more today on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and I'm joined by Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. In our Statehouse Bureau, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter. And also Doug Finke with Gatehouse Media covers the Statehouse. Doug, thanks very much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, Brian and Doug, the governor delivered his budget address. Let's get right to it. What were your takeaways from it?
Balanced is in the eye of the beholder, or maybe in the eye of the speech giver, because this thing either has a $7 billion gap in it, or a $7.2 billion gap in it, depending on how you look at things. Either way, it wouldn't fulfill most people's definition of what a balanced budget is.
Yeah, and I there's this one line on page 30 of this 570-something page document that's the budget book I haven't been around quite as long as some of the other people on the panel today, but it's certainly one of the most unique things I've ever seen on an official state document. There is a line called "Working Together on Grand Bargain, $4.572 billion," which the governor's budget director described that as a combination of reforms, revenue, and economic growth. He did not use the words hope and fairy dust, but that seems to be a little bit in that number, too. It's basically the bottom line is the governor's proposed spending $37.3 billion, and he says Illinois is only going to take in $32.7 billion. And so to make up that difference, we have working together on grand bargain.
But keep in mind also that even with that grand bargain, if they can reach an agreement on it, the governor's proposal depends on the legislature approving a number of things to make it all balance out, which includes making changes to state employee health insurance, some changes to pensions, including creation of a new pension option for new hires, selling the Thompson Center, making changes in state purchasing procedures that they think is going to save $3 billion. All they have to do is get the General Assembly to go along with all that stuff, and then we can work on a grand bargain to balance everything out.
Sure. And the AFSCME contract, because part of that is salaries being frozen, too.
Right.
Charlie, I want to get your thoughts on the budget address, but before we do, the term, balanced budget, Democrats are making a big deal out of the fact that they believe the governor's never actually submitted a balanced budget. Isn't that something that has always been a bit in the eye of the beholder, I guess, in state government, that, some governors have played a little loose with numbers to make it look more balanced in the past?
I guess it depends on how you define balance. Does balance mean that the amount of money you are planning to spend in a given year is equal to or less than the amount of money you're taking in? In that case, this budget clearly isn't anywhere near balanced, nor were either the other two that the governor proposed. On the other hand, and we haven't had one that meets that definition since 2001. On the other hand, if a balanced budget means your revenues are going to exceed your expenditures, so that the backlog is going to be whittled down, Yeah, than we've had several in the last few years. Because don't forget, all these numbers we've discussed so far deal with FY18. Now, add in the amount of money that is owed. And as of this morning, we had $11.9 billion, which the comptroller's office says we owe. And that's not factored in here anywhere. So the deficit, if you will, if the idea is to match spending and outgo so that at the end of the fiscal year, we're in the black, you're still shy like $12 billion. So it's closer to a $20 billion hole, because what that $11.9 billion backlog means is that the first $11.9 billion in revenues that come in are going to go to pay those old bills.
Well, I guess as we move forward, I think all of us can probably agree that the governor's budget plan as written is not going to wind up being put into law that way. It would have to go through a lot of machinations with the General Assembly. So the real concern, I guess, is the so-called grand bargain that they've been working on in the state Senate. Did anything that anybody heard on Wednesday from the governor cause you to believe that that process is going to keep moving forward and things are going to work out and they're going to get something done? Did the governor help or hurt that cause?
I don't know that it's you can say just yet whether it helped or hurt. I know that there were some Democrat senators grumbling privately and publicly afterwards that some of the things the governor said certainly didn't help the cause. For example, he said he is opposed to the sales tax, raising the sales tax on food and medicine. That's well and good, and it's certainly a popular thing to be opposed to that tax. But if he would, that takes a big chunk of revenue out of the picture. And one of the reasons they talked, the senators talked about extending the sales tax to food and drugs, is they would have enough revenue that they could then lower the overall sales tax rate on everything. And there was some belief that that was a kind of a trade-off as well as generating new revenue. So to that degree, the governor didn't help the thing.
Yeah, and he also talked about how he didn't, of course, he campaigned heavily against the income tax, the higher income tax rate that the Democrats had put in 2011 and sunset, or at least rolled back somewhat in right before the governor took office. This grand bargain calls for raising the, it had been 5% previously. This would raise it to 4.99%. So not quite to that same level. But the governor said, no, that's a permanent tax increase. And you're only talking about a partial property tax freeze, something the governor has talked a lot about. And he says, no, that should be a permanent property tax freeze. I suppose to be more accurate, we should say a so-called property tax freeze, because in fact, local governments could still go to their voters and ask to raise property taxes. But it would certainly be a slowdown on adding some bureaucratic hurdles and electoral hurdles to raising property taxes.
Right. And you'd have to assume that school districts, local governments are just going to be apoplectic about the idea that their property taxes would be frozen forever in exchange for an income tax that
2075 property taxes frozen at 2017 rates. Yeah.
And Charlie, your thoughts on it?
Well, I think there's got to be more than meets the eye here. If, in fact, you are going to freeze property taxes, most property taxes collected in Illinois go to local school districts. All local school districts are already under the tax cap law, so they can't ask basically for more money next year than this year at a rate greater than the rate of inflation. And so they're really going to be hamstrung. And there's talk about, well, we can reduce their costs. The main cost are teacher salaries. And at the same time, the governor has mentioned shifting some pension costs onto local school districts. So as I see it, this is a way to say we're going to try and take it out of the hide of public school teachers by ultimately giving school boards discretion whether or not they want to bargain collectively. There's no other way the math will work. It's not so hard for cities, because cities can impose all kinds of taxes. They don't rely on property taxes the same way school districts do.
Now,
I was just saying, this has been something the governor has talked about all along, is this combination or combining a property tax freeze with what he would call mandate relief or something like that. But yeah, basically it allows school districts to outsource more services, private contracts for services, and to have teachers be able to bargain for fewer parts of their jobs, like salary and benefits and things like that.
And Brian, I wanted to ask you, because it sounds though there was a bit of a change in protocol when it came to making this budget available for lawmakers to see before the address was given. So it sounds like this was a pretty big surprise what he said to the lawmakers in the room that day.
Yeah, somewhat. I don't know that it's that surprising. I mean, there were some leaks out about, that he was going to talk about. In fact, he said it himself the day before in a Facebook video that he was going to talk about the so-called grand bargain. But even after the speech had happened, lawmakers were saying, we still don't have the budget book. I guess at some point that afternoon, it was put on the website of the governor's budget office, and you could then go start scrolling through the 570-something pages on your computer or tablet or phone or something and try and make heads or tails of it. But in the past, what would happen is the governor's budget staff would sit down with the legislative caucus budget staffs and brief them. And then those caucuses would work all night and prepare briefings for their members so that when they were sitting there listening to the governor, they would have some sense of what the details of this proposal were. The same goes for the press. We would have a budget briefing during my time here, the last 10, 12 years or so. It's been the night before the budget address. Last year, things kind of took a turn away from that, as I understand it, from the legislative caucuses. Just the budget directors, the individual budget directors, met with the governor's budget director, one sort of one-on-one, not the full staff. And then the press briefing was after the budget address last year. This year, nothing. There were no meetings, at least as far as I understand, there were no meetings beforehand. And certainly the press, we did not get any documentation, and we had a 38-minute session with the budget director after the speech.
And
back in the day when I was an active reporter, and this was quarter century ago, the budget address would be noon on Wednesday. About noon on Tuesday, the press would get all the documents. Then you would have a briefing, say at 1 o'clock, with the budget director and key staff. And then that evening at 7 or so, you'd have an off-the-record, well, not off-the-record, but embargoed briefing with the governor, where the governor would come in, Governor Thompson, Governor Edgar. You could ask him questions about what's in the budget, have him explain it in his own words. And it just made for a much more, as a reporter, it made your job a lot easier because you really understood where the folks were coming from and what the numbers meant, rather than have something dumped on you instantaneously. And back in my day, we didn't have Twitter, we didn't have blogs, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have everything where you're supposed to put something up instantaneously. We actually had time to reflect on what we were going to write.
I do think there's a broader point to be made here, and this is not just about, as Charlie said, it was easier and we had time to think, and that's true, but I do think the governor has complained in recent days that the Democrats didn't really take his proposals seriously the prior 2 years. They just ignored him, he said. And I think that this year you get the feeling that I'm not sure the governor wants anyone to take this proposal that seriously, because if he did, he would have given people more detail and more time to think about it. Mm-hmm. And instead, what we had was an address of platitudes and bromides. And within 24 hours and then the day after that, on Friday, there were some slickly produced ads featuring some key words that he said in the speech where he looks like he's the grand compromiser now, even though this deal that we've been talking about for weeks now has been bubbling up in the Senate and intentionally cut him out and House Speaker Michael Madigan out because the two of them have been so toxic to actually getting something done in state government.
Well, let's go back to the speech, too, because I think if he was not wanting people to take it seriously, well, mission accomplished, I guess, because it seemed as though Democrats especially were almost derisive in how they treated the governor during that speech. And I know many Republicans were upset by that, you know, openly laughing at him on some of his statements. There were signs up. It might not have been the finest day for the Illinois House and Senate being in that chamber that day. The governor also shares some of that blame, I think you could say, as well. But what was the scene like in there? Doug or Brian, I know you were both there. I mean, what was the scene like that day?
Well, true confession time, I think both Doug and I prefer to work in our offices during the budget. There's limited seating in the press box nowadays. And so, you know, the impetus to get stories out, we monitor it down here. But, you know, from watching video and having talked to other people, there was laughter from particularly House Democrats. Some of them held signs up that, you know, said budget equals fake news.
Alternate facts.
Alternative facts. Right. This is not new with Governor Rauner. I think the first year, he had had a line about the minimum wage increase, and Democrats had been pushing for a quick, fairly substantial increase in the minimum wage, and his was a very small increase over a period of many, many years. And I think that, you know, Democrats sort of spontaneously laughed at that. This time, it's a lot more mocking, although it is worth noting that the Illinois Republican Party has spent both last year's campaign season and then it really never ended. They just picked right up and have been attacking particularly House Democrats relentlessly. And so there is no shortage of ill will to go around the Capitol these days.
And Charlie, I'm not trying to compare this, Charlie, to the past necessarily, but at the same time, this doesn't bode well to me. I mean, it really is like a lack of respect on both sides.
Yeah, and in my mind, it kind of reflects what I would say is kind of a general coarsening in society. And I think part of it is social media. I occasionally am foolish enough to read the comment section in the newspapers or online. And the stuff that's in there is just horrible. And I say to myself, would these people who put these anonymous, nasty posts up, would they do it if they had to actually identify themselves? And so what we're seeing in the relationship among members of Congress, of the Illinois legislature, with the executive branch, it kind of reflects what's going on in society. And the level of, I don't know if camaraderie is the right word, but the level of civility, of mutual respect, if you don't particularly like the guy, remember that that person is here in the House because more people in the district voted for that individual than anybody else. And he or she is here representing the will of the electorate. And you have to have respect for the office, even if you think the person who's holding the office is some kind of a jerk.
Doug, I cut you off there. I'll let you have the last word on this.
No, I was just going to say, I agree with everything Charlie said. I somewhat sympathize with the Democrats. I'm not saying that they were right on everything, but there was one section in the speech where Rauner did a lengthy dissertation about the past failures of his budgets, and he said they were ignored by the majority, and there were attempts to reach compromise fell prey to partisan politics. I mean, clearly taking shots at the Democrats, and then he kind of summed all that stuff up, but we're not here to point fingers. Well, I'm sorry, you just pointed fingers for a couple of minutes during your speech, and that got a laughter from the Democratic side.
Yeah, and I know
I
Doug,
think the biggest
you
laugh
gave Doug
line
the last word, but
oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was saying you were going to give Doug the last word, but I'm going to jump in anyway and say that the governor at one point said, and it doesn't help when Democrats do this, that, and the other thing, and it doesn't help when Republicans go to the media to point out that the Democrats have never passed a balanced budget. And I thought, huh. Which Republicans have repeatedly gone to the media to point out that the Democrats have never passed a balanced budget?
Exactly.
Obviously, that's Governor Rauner. He didn't say it doesn't help when I go to the media to point out that. No, he said when Republicans do it. He's clearly, I think, focused on 2018. And, you know, he's delivering sound bites that can be used in advertisements and that make him appear to be some sort of conciliatory, grand compromiser, just want to get things done, rolling up my shirt sleeves, helping out the people of Illinois, image that he is sort of recrafting for himself from the more attack dog, Speaker Madigan's driving Illinois into a ditch. It's just a fact. Facts hurt. You got to live with it. You know, the attitude of his first 2 years in office.
But that's what it's been since he's been in office, though. It's all about image. There's very little substance there. In the area of criminal justice reform, yeah, there's been achievements. But in what the basic job of a governor is to execute the laws, to propose and work with the legislature to adopt a budget, and he's failed. He's the first governor in 198 years who hasn't been able to get a budget together.
And Brian, I do want to switch gears here because you were in a courtroom this week watching a judge respond to Lisa Madigan's request to stop payment for state workers without a budget in place. What happened there and what's the next step?
The bottom line is that state workers are going to continue to be paid. This case goes back all the way to 2015, back when the budget impasse could be measured in days and weeks and not months and years. The AFSCME union sued the state of Illinois to make sure that its workers would continue getting paid. And there was a Supreme Court case that came out in between there that said that no, only the General Assembly has the power of budget appropriation. And that came out last year, a year into the budget impasse. And then there was a stopgap budget. And so the Attorney General has said that it looked like maybe the legislature and the governor were finally beginning to work together. It suggested there could be some future cooperation. Then that stopgap budget largely expires at the end of last year, and she decides to go to court to try and get this order dissolved. AFSCME and the governor's office, strange bedfellows, because they've been fighting for years over the contract, but they joined up to oppose this and say that no, state workers should continue getting paid indefinitely as long as there's no state budget, and the judge agreed with that.
Doug, I know part of her argument, the Attorney General's argument, is that this might help lead to a budget agreement. From the people you've talked to, and you're covering a lot of areas where there are many state workers, you know, are you getting that feeling that this has any bearing whatsoever on, you know, if lawmakers can come together?
Well, clearly, if state employees weren't getting paid anymore, that would create a crisis that would have to be addressed immediately. And the issue is that they could address the state employee pay issue without necessarily reaching agreement on an entire budget. And in fact, a couple of bills have already been introduced in the House, one Republican, one Democrat, to ensure that state workers would continue to get paid even if the courts rule against them. So, I mean, there's a way for them, the legislature, to address the employee pay issue, again, without reaching agreement on an overall budget.
And do we have any idea?
But I think there is some.
Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying there is some thinking that, you know, if you could, you know, that maybe there should be this sort of crisis, right? That's why we have the Constitution that says the legislature and the governor have to, you know, the legislature has the power to appropriate. The governor can sign or veto those bills, and then the legislature can either continue negotiating or override his or her veto. And, you know, if you don't have that, then state government shouldn't function, should shut down. That's what happens in Washington, and that's why shutdowns have been so politically unpopular in Washington, because there are real consequences. State park or national parks get closed. Checks stop moving. The, you know, I don't know if there's a mail stop. I know the Census Bureau stopped working. I happened to work for them many years ago during one of the government shutdowns. And so this is, you know, there are real consequences, and there are not those consequences in Illinois unless you happen to work for a human service agency or an institution of higher education or one of the other several areas of state government that have been more directly affected than state employees.
I did want to save a couple of minutes here because the news came down late in the week that Bob Michael, longtime congressman from Peoria, had been the minority leader in the U.S. House for many years, passed away. He was 93 years old. A lot of condolences and remembrances coming in about Bob Michael. Charlie, I know you didn't cover him directly all that often because you were covering state government. He was at the federal level, but you did have opportunities to see him and follow his career. We just got done talking about the fact of lawmakers today or people in the public eye not necessarily doing a great job of working together all the time, having respect for each other. He was a guy that it at least came across that way, that he could work even with people he disagreed with.
Oh, yeah. He was, I guess, in today's political climate, he would be considered a dinosaur or a throwback, and that he did believe in civility. He did believe in reaching across the aisle. He did believe that it's not about trying to figure out where can we differ. It's about figuring out common ground that we can advance the cause of the general public. So he was a model of what, in my mind, a member of a legislature or a school board or any elected body should be. Somebody who is willing to work with folks whose ideas aren't the same as yours. Someone who would realize that people can disagree on philosophy, on policy, without being disagreeable to each other. And there was, back in the day, Michael was a perfect example of it, but most of the people in Congress were like that back when he was there.
And Ray LaHood worked directly with him, had been an aide to him, and a lot of people viewed Ray LaHood that way.
Yeah, he was Michael's aide, and then when he went to Congress, he was the same kind of person in terms of trying to bring together the, what would you say, Republicans and Democrats to realize that we have more in common in that we're here to serve the voters who sent us here, and we have to find ways to compromise so that we can reach solutions.
Time now for our notes from the field. We'll start at the State House. Doug Finke.
Not directly connected with state government, but somewhat related. The people familiar with the city know that the block due north of the governor's mansion has been a rather unattractive surface parking lot for years and years and years. The city of Springfield has tried to bring some developers in to develop the property. The latest idea that's floating around that apparently has some support from the governor is to turn it into a park that would have certain features similar to Chicago's Millennium Park, including a large, I forget the exact term for it, a video board, and also a tower that people could go up in and view the, I guess, the flatland around Springfield.
Charlie Wheeler?
Well, we're preparing, albeit rather tardily and slowly, to celebrate the state's bicentennial next year. And one of the things that is being considered is changing the date that's on the outside ring of the state seal, which now says August 26th, 1818, which is when the first state constitution was ratified, to December 3rd, 1818, which is when Illinois officially became a state. Legislation to do that passed the House this week overwhelmingly and is now in the Senate.
And Brian Mackey.
Yeah, interesting side note about that AFSCME court case and the Attorney General Lisa Madigan court case. It was filed in St. Clair County, generally thought of as a pretty labor-friendly, Democratic trial lawyer-friendly jurisdiction. The judge in the case is a man named Robert Lachine. He first won election in 98, was retained in 2004 and 2010, up for retention again last year, but decided to resign from that seat and instead run for election to his own vacancy. Of course, retention requires you get 60% of the votes cast. You only need a simple majority, 50% plus one vote, if you are running in a contested election. Judge Lachine rewon the Lachine vacancy with 51% of the vote.
All right. Members for our broadcast today include Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Doug Finke. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.